I'm joined now by Professor Brian Schmidt from the Australia National University, and over the years you have been involved in some of the most fantastic discoveries regarding how our universe is evolving and expanding. Tell us a little bit about it.
I was a leader of a team that used exploding stars, which we call Type 1A supernovae, which have a pretty uniform brightness of about 5 billion times brighter than our sun, so they're pretty remarkable events. And because they're so bright, we can see them across the universe. We can actually see them up to, right now, 11 billion light years in distance. That is, their light has taken 11 billion years to reach us. So these objects allow us to measure relative distances. These objects, when they're further and further away, become fainter and fainter, just like a light does here on Earth. And by seeing exactly their brightness, we can judge exactly how far away they are. And so when we go out and measure the expanding universe, like Hubble did, the way we make that measurement in the nearby universe is we measure how far away an object is, and we compare it to how much space has stretched between us. We often call that how fast that object is moving away from us. And it turns out that object's not really moving away from us. It's actually the creation of space between us, and it looks almost exactly the same.
The universe is essentially moving away for us. It's not actually has its own motion necessarily. The universe itself is expanding.
Yeah, the universe is expanding. And so in that expansion, if we measure and compare distance to expansion rate of a nearby object, that allows us to measure how fast the universe is expanding right now. Now, when we look at one of these really distant objects, then the expansion that we're seeing is in the past. We can actually look into the past of our universe and see what it was doing, 10 billion years ago, for example. And when we did this and presented our results in 1998, and another team did the same thing, we both found something very peculiar, which is that the universe was expanding slower in the past and is expanding faster now. Now, the reason that's crazy is we know the universe is full of gravity. That is, people like you and me are made up of atoms, and we have gravity. And gravity, the collective gravity of everything in the universe, should slow it down. But what we saw instead was that the universe was speeding up, like there's something unknown force pushing on it. So it's sort of like taking a ball and throwing it up in the air and then have it take off and go into orbit. That's essentially what we've seen. So it's pretty crazy. So
it's the same sort of anti-gravity force, something blowing the universe even faster than we expected.
That's right. So we expected to see the universe slowing down because of gravity sort of tugging on the universe. We've seen it speeding up, and we don't really know why it's doing this, but the best guess we have is we actually go back to Einstein, who back in 1917 invented something he called the cosmological constant. It's energy that's tied to space itself. It's like every piece of space has this bit of energy associated with it. And it turns out if you have this in space, Einstein realized that it would cause the universe to speed up. And effectively, this stuff naturally pushes on itself. And since it's tied to space, as the universe expands, you get more and more of this stuff over time. You essentially get the universe bigger and bigger, you get more and more of this stuff, and it can push on itself. And so you end up with a universe that'll run away from itself. It'll just get faster and faster over time. And that seems to be what we've seen. But unfortunately, there's a lot of problems with Einstein's model. If you go out and use particle physics techniques, you can try to estimate how big this would be caused by quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, you come up with a number which is about a 1 with 120 zeros larger than the value we've measured. Now, that's pretty bad measurement.
There's something definitely wrong there, isn't there?
One would say that that's considered to be the largest mistake ever made in physics. Even today, no one's come close. Okay. So the question is, how do you get rid of that? And normally, the way you get rid of these things when you don't know what's going on is you assume that there's something else in particle physics that's canceling its effect out. And it's very easy when you do these things to get them to cancel out exactly. It's almost impossible to get it cancel out to one decimal place in 120. So it's a big mystery of whether or not this cosmological constant really makes sense. So we're looking for other things to see if we can find some particle or something that's filling space and maybe changing a little bit over time that could be causing the universe to run away.
Are there any ideas? These are theoretical particles. We looked at quantum mechanics and how the quantum mechanics of the vacuum of the universe could produce this expansive force. But as you say, it doesn't seem to fit what we actually observe. So are there any ideas on these exotic particles that could be producing this magical energy?
There are lots of ideas. There are thousands of ideas. Indeed, that's all we have right now are ideas. The problem with these ideas is that they can predict anything. And there's no real way to say this idea is right or this idea is wrong. And so at this point, we have theory after theory after theory that end up looking exactly the same. But there's no real reason to choose one theory over the other. They're all made up. They're cartoons where people say, I'm going to invent something, and it works. And another person says, I'm going to invent something else, and it'll work.
Yeah.
But there's no reason, there's nothing you can test. You can't say, this one's right because it predicted this behavior. They don't predict anything. Mm. So they're not real theories. They're really just a sketch, a guess of what's going on. And so we're really struggling right now to figure out what's going on.
Our best description, theoretically, of the universe and how it expands and evolves is Einstein's theory of general relativity. And he mentioned that when he came up with it, he added in, where he had this cosmological constant as a natural result of his calculations, his theories. However, he himself didn't like it very much, did he?
Well, at the time, he figured it was a necessary evil, because in 1917, when he first looked at how the universe should be expanding, his equation said the universe should be expanding or contracting, and he looked around and he thought we lived in the Milky Way, our galaxy, and there didn't appear to be any expanding or contraction, and so he was kind of scared, because he was very attached to his theory. So he looked and he said, there's actually a little thing, this little constant I can add to it, and it sort of fixes this problem. Then when it was realized in 1929 that the universe was expanding, this term sort of disappeared. And it's been reinvented by other people. But yeah, he didn't like it. He considered it one of his biggest blunders, according to George Gamow. And so it sort of disappeared on its own, because ultimately it's unnecessary. We thought it was an unnecessary thing to describe our universe. Mm. And there's no real way to say why it should be there at the value, as separate through quantum mechanics, which then gives the wrong answer. So it did fade away. But now it seems to have reared its ugly head again, and it's been very good over the last 7 or 8 years of predicting what we would see. Indeed, it hasn't really put a foot wrong with the better and better measurements that we've used, using the cosmic microwave background, but also doing surveys of the galaxies around our own, and measuring how much gravity there's there. And all these things seem to give the same answer, that Einstein's cosmological constant is it.
Let's go back to the tool that you use to describe how the universe is changing its acceleration over time, these standard candles, these supernova. Please tell us a little bit more about the particular type of supernova that you're using. And because we understand that there are supernovas and supernovas, there's not just one flavor. Tell us a little bit more about the particular type of supernova that you use to trace the universe's evolution.
Our supernovae are ones which we call thermonuclear detonations. They're like giant atomic bombs. And that differentiates them from the other flavor of supernovae, which are what we call core collapse. They're big stars that collapse down into almost like black holes, and they get their energy from gravitational energy, not from the nuclear bomb flavor. So ours are the nuclear bomb ones, and the idea is that we have stars, which we call white dwarfs. White dwarfs are the remnants of stars like our sun. When they run out of hydrogen, which they turn into helium to power themselves, the center of them collapse down to this tiny thing about the size of the Earth, but the mass of the sun. So, you know, a teaspoon of material on these things weighs a ton, for example. So these are interesting stars, because when you add material to them, the stars actually get smaller. They have such strong gravity that, you know, the extra gravity makes them get smaller, and their electrons are pushing out on them against gravity. And every time you add a little bit more material, the star gets a little smaller, and gravity gets a little stronger. And Chandrasekhar showed that when you get to almost 1.4 times the mass of the sun, the next atom that you put on, gravity overwhelms the electrons, and the whole thing tries to start to collapse towards a black hole. But this thing is a nuclear powder keg. It's full of carbon and oxygen, which can be fused into iron. And when you do that, you get basically nuclear energy, just like a hydrogen bomb does. These are a carbon-oxygen bomb. So you have a nuclear bomb, which is roughly 1.5 times the size of our sun. And so when they explode, it ends up shining about 5 billion times our sun's brightness for on order of a month.
And why can we use them as standard candles? Why are their luminosities, or the light output that they produce, allow us to figure out how far away they are?
So because these things seem to explode when they reach this precise value, it turns out we think it's 1.38 times the mass of our sun, you could imagine that you have a very similar explosion each time. You put that last atom on, the thing runs away, and you have a 1.38 solar mass atomic bomb.
So you essentially have exactly the same amount of material and therefore exactly the same amount of energy every time one of these things goes off.
Right. And if that were completely true, then each one of these objects would look identical. Life is not quite so simple. It turns out that these stars may be rotating. We're not really sure all the details. So there is a slight variation of about 20 or 30% across all types of these type 1a supernovae. But we can calibrate these. We actually look out into the universe and we see these things in the expanding universe, and we can use the expanding universe, how much the space is stretched as our ruler. It's a relative ruler, but it's quite good. And so when we do that, we can sort of tweak these things, and what we found is that if they expand slower, then these objects tend to be brighter than those that get brighter and fainter more quickly. And so that calibration allows us to use these things with an accuracy of about 7 or 8%.
That's a remarkable accuracy for the sort of research that you're doing. You've managed to measure how the universe starts to expand faster with these remarkable objects. When did the universe begin to expand faster and faster?
And when we look back into time, we can see the universe sort of turn over. So you have the universe full of matter like ourselves that gravitates. But as the universe gets bigger and bigger, that material gets diluted because the universe's volume is getting bigger and containing the same amount of atoms. Whereas the dark energy, which is tied to space, is being created. Mm. And so we think at about 5 billion years ago, about the time the Earth was being formed, the dark energy started to overwhelm the gravitating matter and take over and start running the universe away. And so we can sort of see that turnover 5 billion years ago.
Here's a tricky question, because many of our listeners will probably be aware of thermodynamics and how we are always taught at school you cannot create energy. However, it seems the universe is doing just that, with creating its own energy, which is blowing itself apart. Any thoughts on why? Where is this energy coming from? Or is that just the way it is?
Yeah, it turns out within general relativity, thermodynamics doesn't work quite the way people think. And so there is a way of not so much conserving energy, but you can conserve a quantity in general relativity. And when you do that, everything works out just fine. Everything is balanced in a general relativistic way. But it is not the normal thing. It is like this stuff's being created from nothing. But within the accounting framework of general relativity, all is well. And so it's a fairly controversial thing to figure out how to express this in through the normal laws of general relativity. But you have, the idea is that bits of the universe are disappearing from you, and you have to keep track of all that. And when you do it, it does seem to, there's no real problem. But it's not going to be explainable in an easy way. It's a very hard thing to explain, even amongst the people who work on this full time.
Supernovae are not rare events. We observe, we observe them routinely. However, it's the end of a star's life. And you need to be able to discover many of these supernovae at many distances to be able to do this research. How are you capturing the data that you require to draw your conclusions?
A supernova in our own galaxy of 10 billion suns explodes about every 250 years. So you could imagine that if you look at 250 galaxies every day for a year, you will eventually find a supernova. And that's more or less the technique we do. We don't look at 250 galaxies. We look at 10,000 galaxies, so we can find a lot of them. So there's, in the distant universe, that isn't so hard, because when we look up and look a long, long ways away, within a pretty small space of a telescope's field of view, you can see 10,000 galaxies. Mm. And so you just keep taking pictures, and you'll see these things explode in one of the galaxies and monitor them. And that's how we traced back the objects at 5 or even 10 billion years ago. Much more challenging is in the nearby universe, because if you just go and take a small telescope and look in the nearby universe, there won't be a single galaxy in the average telescope's field of view that, is really close. And so you have to go through and do one thing, build a new generation of telescope, which we're doing at Mount Stromlo, that can look at about 40 full moons worth of sky at a time. That's called SkyMapper. But the way people have done it over the last 10 or 15 years is to just take and point at all the nearby galaxies and have dedicated telescopes that just keep on taking these pictures. And they've got them so they can take several thousand pictures a night now. Wow. And you have a computer process them and find the thing, and then, you know, you raise the alarm bells when suddenly you see a new object. And that has been the way that people have done it. And many amateurs, including several people here in the UK, have been very successful at doing this at home. And so that's quite a complement between professional surveys and these amateur surveys. I would say it's almost a 50-50 split right now in the nearby universe.
Is there more work to be done, or have we learned all that we're going to learn from the supernovae and the expansion of the universe?
Well, there's always more to learn. It's just not as easy as it has been in the last 10 years. And so the problem we have is that we are able now to trace back distances to 7, 8, 10 billion years to almost 1% accuracy. And then the problem is now that we're getting into what we call systematic errors, errors where we're consistently making the same mistake. And this can be caused by supernovae, for example, changing a little bit back in time, but can also be caused by just not being able to accurately deal with the atmosphere and how we measure the brightness of objects, especially as their light gets shifted to the red. That's a very challenging thing to do. And so it becomes more and more work, and so to try to improve our measurements that we've made so far, we have to take huge amounts of data and sift through all the possible problems. And so we're doing that, and in the process we get to learn a lot about how interesting supernovae are, which is one of my favorite topics anyway. But that's what's required, is to get a more and more detailed understanding of these exploding stars so that we can gradually creep in and look for how the dark energy that's ripping the universe apart might be different from Einstein's version. At this point, we haven't seen any difference, but that's our hope, is we might.
That's fantastic. We wish you all the best for the future research. Now, here at the National Astronomy Meeting in Queen's University, Belfast, there's an awful lot of exciting science going on. So apart from your own research, what do you think is the next big topic, the next exciting thing which we're learning about here at this meeting?
Well, there's a whole range of things, from going and finding planets by looking at monitoring millions of stars' light and seeing the planet do a transit and cause a little eclipse. It's a great way to find objects not dissimilar to our own Earth. So that's on one thing. And then another thing on the completely other end of the universe is to look at the first stars in our universe and see how at about more than 13 billion years ago, we can see the first black holes and galaxies forming and lighting up the universe and taking the hydrogen in the universe and stripping its electron off for the first time. So we really know that's the beginning of when stars and galaxies are being built. So I think those are two really exciting topics that are happening on different scales of the universe. And there's, of course, millions of things in between. And so there's a really, it's very exciting time in astronomy right now.
Certainly is. One last question. How did you get started in astronomy?
I always enjoyed astronomy as a child. My parents bought me a very cheap telescope when I was about 10, and I remember seeing Jupiter for the first time when I was about 10. So I continued to be interested in astronomy, but I never thought I would do it until my last year of school before university, and I had to figure out what I was going to do. And I just couldn't think of what I was going to do, so I said, well, I'll do astronomy because I'd do it for free. Now, I never figured I'd actually remain an astronomer. I figured I'd do it to learn about something, and then I'd become something else when the time was right. Well, that time never happened, and I've remained an astronomer. So it was sort of by accident, but I certainly don't regret it.
I think we're lucky that you stuck with it. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.